Welcome to Innovation in the Burg, a podcast about science and innovation in St. Petersburg. If you're a self-described science or technology geek, or even if you aren't, this will be a fun and informative conversation. I'm Allison Barlow, Executive Director of the St. Pete Innovation District. Each podcast, I'm joined by a local science or technology expert who will talk about what they're working on. But to make sure we keep this in perspective and don't become too technical, we have a community member joining us. Our hope is that you learn something new and enjoy our conversation. Let me introduce today's guests. Our experts today are John Paul and Bob Ulrich, two of the founders of Pure Molecular. Pure Molecular is a University of South Florida spinoff company formed in mid-2014. They provide services and technology for seafood species authentication to ensure quality and combat mislabeling fraud. The company was formed as part of their research at the university. I have to also say a special acknowledgement of Pure Molecular. They were our first stop on our first tour of the Innovation District a year ago, almost this week. Our community member is Jason Mathis. Jason is the CEO of the St. Petersburg Downtown Partnership. Established in 1962, the partnership is focused on promoting urban growth and redevelopment that strengthens and diversifies the economy in downtown St. Petersburg. Their shareholders are local businesses and institutions who support a variety of economic development projects that might not otherwise happen without the partnership involvement. And I have to say, one of the best examples of the work of the partnership is Pure Molecular. They were part of the beginning. So it's great to have both these groups together today. Let me start by asking our expert, JP, the first question. How did you get interested in studying this, the seafood authentication and marine science and all of this?
Well, I'd like to go backwards and how did I become a marine microbiologist? I had an uncle who was a very favorite uncle of mine who was a professor at Syracuse, Dr. Ralph Slepecki, and he was world authority on bacillus, which is a type of bacterium, but he was also the cool guy. He was the bachelor who drove the two-seater sports car, and he was a lot of fun. And I became interested in microbiology, but I was also interested in the marine side of it because I was a surfer in South Jersey. So I became a marine microbiologist, and that's the way we stepped forward into this area.
Is that just your excuse to be able to spend more time on the water?
Yeah, well, the thing is, like everybody else, I just spend more time behind a computer.
So tell us how that decision evolved into what you're doing today and a little bit about what you're doing.
Well, one of the things that we've been interested in is genetic identification of life. And we do this as a marine scientist to understand how the ocean works. And we look at microorganisms and fish and identify them and what their role is in the ecosystem and what their role is in fisheries and also in harmful algal blooms. So that was basically the start of my interest. And then Bob Ulrich got his PhD on verifying grouper, because 30% of the grouper sold in the United States is mislabeled either inadvertently or incorrectly. And what happens is that the consumer ends up eating something like Asian catfish instead of grouper. So we started this company and our grouper was our first project, but then we also had a tremendous interest in red tide detection and molecular techniques to detect the red tide organism, which has really hit the Gulf of Mexico very hard in Tampa Bay this year. And we've been working with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Corporation, and we've been providing molecular identification of their red tide organisms to see where they're coming from and how genetically related they are. And then we got into biomedical applications that are sensitive in that we're just starting them and we're not at liberty to describe the intricacies of that relationship, but it's going to be a very big hit as far as I can tell.
That's awesome. So you're able to take something that you started in the marine science world and take it through different applications in marine science, but then also starting to look at other industries, which I think is fascinating. So Bob, real quick, how did you pick grouper? Why grouper? Why not another fish?
It was actually that project was gifted to me. So I started out and I got my master's in microbiology at USF Tampa and I came to manage JP's lab at USF St. Pete in, I think it was about 2006. And we were working on various projects. And at that time, JP and his postdoc at the time, Dave John, had an idea for a Florida Sea Grant application. And grouper was always of interest. And we had a dean at the time, Bill Hogarth, who came from a fisheries background. And there was some kind of internal dialogue. And Bill kind of said, if you can devise a sensor or something that's portable and easy to use that can detect non-species, and not just grouper, if just fraudulent fish, the world will beat a path to your door. Well, it kind of happened, but indirectly.
Not so much. Yeah.
So we got the grant, and the grant required a graduate student involvement. And I've been wanting to get my PhD after a while, and I had a perfect opportunity. And JP's like, I need a guy on this. I need a student on this. This is in your wheelhouse. What do you say? Do you want to be poor again for 4 years? So we started that, and the project went very well. And we had some external support to Guy Harvey. The Guy Harvey Scientific Oceanographic, I believe its foundation is the nomenclature, he got involved as well. He was very interested. So we got some financial support from him as well. And the Southeastern Fisheries, I forget the acronym, was another fisheries division of the South Atlantic Fisheries Foundation. They got word of it as well, and they gave us some support. So we had three or four lines of funding for it from various interesting parties. And we did it. I mean, we took it to proof of concept. We got instrumentation, we got chemistries, and we showed it worked. And then the news got involved, the local news. And this was a story, I think it was spearheaded by the St. Pete Times 10 or 15 years ago. They got wind of fraudulent fish, primarily grouper in the St. Pete, Pinellas area, when they did a giant expose on it. And they found that 75, 80% of the restaurants that they blindly tested were serving fake fish. And then I believe the state attorney's office got a hold of that and then did a further investigation from the St. Pete Times article. And they went and did a deeper dive, and they found the same thing. Like, man, this is a big problem. And it's a global problem, really, but we started here.
One of the last exposés that was done on this was the white tuna controversy in Jacksonville. There were sushi shops selling white tuna, and there is no such thing as white tuna. What it was escalar. And escalar is a very oily fish that causes a lot of gastroenteritis and diarrhea. So if you got diarrhea from eating at a sushi bar, chances are you were served white tuna.
So Jason, you're new to St. Pete and you're first hearing about all this.
Yeah, I didn't know what to expect a whole conversation on diarrhea today. That was not on my agenda, but it's fascinating. I've only been here since August and I came from the mountains. Our seafood there is often served in a can.
Yes.
So the idea of sort of fish detectives going out and trying to track this stuff down is fascinating. And as a new Floridian, I feel a real obligation to order grouper every time I go someplace because I want to fit in. Like, I want to be part of the team. So I'm realizing now that maybe, you know, there's a chance that in the last few months, I may have been served some.
Well, here's the interesting part of that. I think we're our own worst enemies. Since we started this division, it's not just the grouper sensor. We also do in-house lab validation too. So it takes a little bit longer, but we can actually detect the species of what the replacement fish is. And like I said, the moose got picked up. And since we've been doing this for 4 or 5 years, we've found very little incidents in this local area just because it's on everyone's tongue and everyone knows people were looking for it and it was a big to-do. What we've found the most fraudulent, we did a couple exposés for, I believe, with Jacksonville. When we found 100% of like 20 samples was escalar instead of whatever white tuna they're calling it. And then we did a rather big one, I think, in 2015. From Atlanta area news agency tested 40 or 50 samples, and we found about 15% of those were Asian catfish too. So it seems like this area, you're okay since what we've been testing.
We put the fear of God in the
local restaurants. Yeah, that's basically what it was.
They don't want to see us coming.
No, and I think a lot of people who remember that whole news series, I mean, I remember it when it was in the St. Pete Times, and I think I was just maybe transitioning back here or I was visiting. People still remember it and talk about it. So it definitely hit home. I'm curious, though, tell me more, JP or Bob, about the red tide detection, because you guys mentioned it's hot. It's a big issue for us right now.
Well, about 10 or 15 years ago, we actually developed an assay specific for the Florida red tide organism, which scientific name is Carinia brevis. And the assay is extremely specific and can differentiate between other species that look just like Carinia brevis but aren't toxic. So we put in an application to NOAA and collaborated with the Fish and Wildlife Corporation there. And Catherine Hubbard, who's the head of the red tide detection for the state of Florida, is my co-principal investigator. And we've done side-by-side testing of the traditional method, which is using a microscope and counting these little buggers, and I can't tell them apart. They all look the same. But the specialist can differentiate the toxic ones from the non-toxic ones, but we can operate and detect with 100% effectiveness in about 15 minutes, maybe another 15 minutes to extract the nucleic acid. And then if it's there, we get a really bright signal and we can tell that the red tide's there. And it's much more sensitive than microscopy. We can tell when red tides are just thinking about blooming. They're a gleam in the bloom's eye, so to speak. Yeah.
Well, and I think it's fascinating. I've seen the device that you guys use, and it's almost like a little tabletop, size of a laptop, I guess, roughly. And so it's very portable. So is my understanding when you're working with Kate and all of the red tide detection, you're also out in the field a little bit.
Yeah, and let me jump in there. When I started in JP's lab, like I said, 10, 15 years ago, one of the coolest projects I was working on is taking that molecular assay for Karenia brevis, and we were trying to integrate it into a biobuoy, an autonomous biobuoy, which is basically just this
I was
giant,
about to say, what is a biobuoy?
It's a very generic term for fancy gizmos, but it was a sealed container, and it had robotics and instrumentation that basically did what a lab technician on the bench automatically in the can. So basically, it filtered water, it extracted the RNA out of that, it moved around, it performed the actual molecular amplification, and it had a little fluorometer in it that actually read. So basically, it was just like that little machine, but it was autonomous. We take it out, we fill it with its chemistry and its batteries, throw it in the water, and then not only does it perform the assay in real time, it telemetered data back to the land. So you can put these things out in various locations and it'll do the assay. It'll tell you if you have a hit or a not hit. It'll ping data back to your whatever home base you have, and you have real-time monitoring.
That's fascinating. So, Jason, you're hearing about all this. Any questions, things that you're trying to figure out from what they're saying?
Well, I thank you for putting it into plain English, because often when scientists talk, I nod, and I know they're speaking English, but I don't understand what they're saying. But I'm picking it up. I'm tracking with you. I will say it's not a question, but more of an observation, that prior to coming to St. Petersburg, I didn't really understand the relationship that marine science had here with the larger community. Since I've come here, I've really come to appreciate that. And the partnership, the organization I work for, has a long relationship with the College of Marine Science. And Peter Betzer, our past president, was the dean of the science. We have a really good relationship with Bill Hogarth, who you've mentioned, and a long-term relationship. One thing I will say, in every community, there's something special that makes that community unique. And you think about Detroit when Ford Motors was getting started, and that was the headquarters for car manufacturing. Or you think about the Bay Area and San Jose at the start of the Silicon Valley and the computer revolution. For so many reasons, this community is the headquarters. This is the heart for marine science for the entire nation and maybe for the entire world. I mean, you think about the for-profit companies, the research that's doing, the applied research, the real research, the connection we have, so many people that are part of this ocean community, this ocean team, and it's incredible. And I don't know that people outside of St. Petersburg are aware of that. And probably there's some people in St. Petersburg who don't even know about it, but it's absolutely remarkable. And I'm excited to tell that story. Like I think, and I'm not a scientist, but I am excited about the science that's happening in my new hometown. It's really, really cool.
I think you're exactly right. And you mentioned Kate Hubbard, who we'll give a shout out to Kate because she is so often in the science community. You guys all know her, and I consider her a rock star in the world of red tide. But outside, people were talking about red tide this year, and Kate's name wasn't coming up. And I was like, why isn't people asking Kate? And a little trivia for you, Jason, as a newbie, the scientific name of red tide, JP, do you want to tell him where that came from, the local connection to the scientific name?
The organism used to be named Gymnodinium breve. But because Karen Steininger was one of the first scientists to realize the importance of the Gymnodinium breve, they changed the name to Karenia brevis after Karen Steininger.
And she was a local.
She was with the Florida Fish and Wildlife for maybe 30 years, and she got her degree at USF Tampa.
So that's our connection. So even the red tide is named after a local. Yeah. That's the sort of unknown known. So I'm curious, JP, what does a bad day look like for a marine scientist studying authentication?
When nothing works in the lab.
When none of the equipment works.
Yeah, when you're staring at zeros.
Nothing works in all of it.
But there's information to be got out of that, too. I mean, they're informative. I mean, like I said, a lot of the stuff when monitoring we do, we cast a wide net and Like, I think something, some of the data that JP is referring to is one of the latest projects that we worked with Kate Hubbard with was creating this volunteer array network to use our instrumentation.
So let me add there, it's volunteer scientists, or citizen scientists is the term,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly, citizen scientists, yeah. And they actually have other projects going on when they're doing some remote microscopy as well. Because people love it. I mean, people love being involved. A lot of times it's retirees or part-timers that just love to be out there. So right now, a lot of the water that's being collected for red tide monitoring microscopy is collected by volunteers. They go out and they grab the water and they FedEx back here and they count the microbes here. So we had, and JP and Kate got this grant from NOAA to create this citizen network. So they take our assay out, they run it out into the beach or try to cast, I think it was 10 sites across all the state and do the assay right there, get information, whether it's positive or negative, within an hour, and then report back. And then we have another collaborator, Bob Currier, created this web portal that all this data is stored at, and it's easy accessible. It's all collated data, and it can be used by the public. It's used by scientists, and it's really cool. So more or less, it's in real time. Instead of somebody in the panhandle having to drive out, grab water, FedEx it back to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission, and then waiting for them to count it, which could take a week, especially with all this inundation, we'll know within a couple hours whether that site was impacted with red tide. Not only that, how concentrated. Because presence-absence is a little bit of an arbitrary term, but we want to know, is it present, but how bad? Because I don't know if you kind of know the gradations of slow, moderate, severe, how the FWC reports the data.
Is that where they do the color coding?
Yeah, the colors, yeah.
I've seen on the map.
The red is the 10 million or the million above per liter, and then you got background singles too. So, and that's important in prediction. So yeah, everyone, we kind of say that, okay, you have red tide out there. What can you do about it? Well, you can't really mitigate it right now, but what you can do is have early warnings.
Right.
So if we can see from this time scale, okay, we're starting to see a little bit higher here, a little bit higher here, get these people ready or close these shellfish beds because it's coming. And it's patchy, but that's how it's combated best right now is to take quantitative measurements in time scales. And like I said, a bad day is zeros, but I'd rather see zeros than have red tide. But
true.
It's not great for compiling data in a relatively short term over a grant life. You want to see some hits as a scientist.
You kind of need that.
You want to see some spikes.
Yeah.
But like you say, zeros are data too.
So I'm curious from an innovation standpoint, how do you decide, okay, we got this great thing that works for a grouper and now we want to try it in red tide or we want to try it in the life science arena? Is it just a random thing or do you get a discussion? How does it happen?
Well, the first part is the literature. We go to the scientific literature. I sort of have an algorithm for developing these assays. And we see, has somebody already done this? Is there somebody who's got a particular gene target that works for this organism? And then what I do is I align all the genes of the target sequence versus the non-targets. In other words, I do a DNA sequence alignment, which gives us instructions on where we can attack the molecule of DNA or RNA to detect specifically that particular organism or that particular need. And Bob just kind of glossed over it, but the shellfish beds have to be tested and they have to have less than 5,000 cells per liter before the shellfish bed can be opened for harvesting. So there's real commercial need now for these kind of assays in the field. And the other thing, we've developed an assay for the cyanobacteria in the Microcystis aeruginosa, which is the thing that's coming out of Lake
Okeechobee.
You've heard all the blue-green.
The blue-green algae.
Yeah. So there's no end in sight to the applications or targets that we can develop for this work. We've also developed an enterovirus probe and a norovirus. Norovirus is the cruise ship diarrhea.
More diarrhea.
Yeah, we're back.
It's a theme. There's a theme I'm sensing with our podcast today.
And projectile vomiting.
Oh, great.
Just in time for lunch.
And those organisms are extremely virulent. It takes 10 viruses to give an infection. So there's a lot of need for this type of work for water quality and monitoring of the environment and the safety of our water and also potentially our food sources.
Go ahead, Bob. And then
I'm going to say, I think the lead in the question is, how do you go out and find these markets?
Yeah.
These markets kind of found us, to tell you the truth. So we had the marine hub, we had the Karenia, we had the red tide, we had the grouper. The clinical stuff actually came from us, from one of our board members, Mike Morris, who actually started Ocean Optics in Dunedin, which was a $50 million company. Great job. And he's still with us today. And he's like, he knows people because he's in the sensor world. He makes sensors that are on the moon or Mars or whatever. So he's been doing sensor development. JP knew when he was a grad student at CMS 20 or so years ago. And through Mike Morris's connections, he's like, I kind of know these guys down here that got something cool for grouper. And DNA is DNA, RNA is RNA. Do you think that
you could reapply
it? Yeah, I could reapply it. And of course, yeah. I mean, we were so narrow scoped and it's basically just us and a handful of people. So we had to stay pretty focused. And that's how we were told too. When we first started out, we had a lot of advice saying, go to trade shows. Mm-hmm. Tell people what you do and what you do well. And that's kind of how Mike Morris started. He went to trade shows and I had a bunch of people coming up to him from different fields or different markets. Like, I see a solution in what you're producing.
So let them bring you an idea.
Just get your stuff out there and be able to communicate it. That's important. This is very important, is to be able to communicate what you do and not make people's eyes crossed.
Yeah, totally. And I want to turn to Jason because the whole purpose of the downtown partnership is making key investments. And you guys made an early investment in this organization.
And in Ocean Optics, actually.
Oh, see, I didn't realize that.
Two for two.
Well, we have some other ones that maybe haven't panned out quite so well, but that's the nature of investments.
But why is that kind of investment important? And why the role of the partnership so important, do you think?
Well, I'll say this is a really unusual downtown organization because we do make these kinds of investments. There's lots of downtown organizations around the country that don't have the same structure and same plan in terms of investing in startup companies or support for marine science. We provide grants for some fellowships and some scholarships at the College of Marine Science as well. And the reason that we do it, again, is because this community is so unique and because the marine science economy in St. Petersburg is so critical to our future development as a city, as a community. It's an asset that we have because of really this world-renowned College of Marine Science and then all of the spin-off businesses that have resulted from that. You know, I think about the role that we have, the location that we have being surrounded by water on this peninsula, the brilliant minds that are at work here, both in pure research and applied research. You think about the concentration of companies and organizations and brilliant people, which really is the point behind the Innovation District. I mean, that's your whole goal as an organization, is to collate all of these people together in a confined geographic area where you have marine science, you have life science, you have entrepreneurs, you have people just doing pure research, you have people who are trying to figure out how do we monetize this. That's the magic, I think, that creates, I mean, I'll exaggerate a little bit here maybe, but I really do think that in some ways, this community is uniquely poised to help save the world as we think about global warming, which is real, as we think about rising oceans, as we think about the acidification of the ocean, as we think about all these things that are affecting coastal communities around the world, a lot of the answers for how we as a species are going to solve that are going to come from this community. And that's a pretty exciting story to tell. That's really, from an outside perspective, as a non-scientist, I look at this stuff and I think, I'm so honored and grateful to get to live in this city where these brilliant people are working on these solutions that are going to change our world. So surfing really has changed the world.
Well, I think your point is well taken. People who love the ocean also care about all these other issues and they come together. It's interesting for the Innovation District, we did an event called State of Science back in October, and we featured 8 speakers for marine science and for life science. They each had only 6 minutes to talk about what they do. And I wasn't sure, candidly, the audience was mixed. You know, there were some people who had a propensity for one area or the other. I had more feedback from people who were maybe in the medical field who were going, oh my God, that life, the marine science stuff was so cool, and vice versa. And so I do think that everybody's open to kind of seeing the connections. And to your point, a lot of what we do, Bob was mentioning going to trade shows, we kind of emulate that with constantly getting people to talk about what they do. Because you get so caught up in what you do, you forget that it's cool.
Yeah.
We jokingly always give a hard time. I'll give Kim at NOAA a shout out too, because we'll often, Kim will be in this one meeting that we have periodically, and we go around the table and sort of talk about what everybody's doing. And Kim's always at the end. I don't know why. And oftentimes she's like, I don't have a good story. And we're like, yes, you do. We promise you do. And she always has the best story of the day. She's had a story about dolphin hearing tests, and she's had a story about some work out at Fort DeSoto, and it's just been cool stuff. So I'm curious, JP, you mentioned your uncle inspired you. Any other rock stars out there in science and technology that you love?
Well, I'd like to add to Jason's comments. He pointed out the scientific prowess that our community has, but St. Pete is a great place to live. When people come here, they stay here. I came here 35 years ago, and I haven't left, and I'm retiring. I've had one job, basically, at USF as a professor. And we see that that's generally the case amongst the faculty of the marine science. They come, they stay. they raise their families. It's a great place to live. And this next generation really loves science. We have those science days down in Bayborough Harbor. The crowds grow from 5,000 to 10,000. And it's amazing with all the other activities that are available in the state and in Orlando and all the other parts of the state. Science is something that really, really turns people on. And this is a great place to do it and a great place to live. And I'm honored to have been here. And I'm honored to be a part of your presentation today.
And will we have to say kudos in case I forget, because retirement is how many months away? You're counting down, I know.
It's 33 days away.
I thought months.
It's what time one is it?
Yeah.
But that's only retiring from the university, yes. Albeit for molecular.
Oh, yeah. He's working harder than ever now, trust me.
So going back to who inspires you in science, who do you like? Or Bob, anybody that you like to watch out for?
To me, I like being in the lab. I like doing the bench work. I like the people. And definitely the professors. Talking about inspiration, I had a mentor, Dr. Jody Harwood, started out. I got my master's with her, too. She was fantastic. And she was energetic. She was positive reinforcement. Give enough rope to hang yourself. And that's what JP did with his graduate students as well, is don't get in their way too much. Let them try to figure stuff out and then guide them and mentor them. The people that I end up admiring the most are kind of the middlemen of the science, the technicians and the postdocs. The people that aren't making any money, they're not getting a lot of the clout. I mean, they get the publications, but they're not doing this a lot of times. There's somebody in our lab right now who came from JP's lab. I guarantee you she's running 15 assays today.
At the same time.
And yeah. And then she doesn't need a lot of recognition, but that's the machinery that makes this work. And then as a professor, Sheringham John can attest to that. He sits in his office and writes grants all day and upper level stuff. But that's who inspires me the most, is the person that wants the degree, or the technician or the intern that gets in there at 8 a.m. and washes dishes just because they want to be in the lab and get experience. That's the inspiration I see too. And my wife is a professor at SPC. She teaches immunology and microbiology. And that's kind of what jazzes her too, is get them started young and early and inspire them. And that's the work ethic inspires me. It really does. Yeah.
Is that why we leave at 3 o'clock?
I'm not a technician anymore.
You don't have that problem. So what's next for Pure Molecular? What should we be watching out for?
We can't say.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, we can't say. But what we can say, and that's, you kind of keep alluding to that. What are the commonalities between grouper and red tide and clinical microbes?
And by clinical, we're talking about
bacteria and viruses,
yep.
Pathogens, things that cause cold or cause norovirus.
Human stuff.
Yeah, human stuff, yes. Not just environmental stuff. So we've transitioned from environmental to more human stuff, if you will. And it's amazing how similar that is. I mean, a microbe in the ocean is very similar to a microbe that's causing you diarrhea.
Yep.
Genetically, anyway. I mean, they function the same. So I think JP kind of came up with our catchphrase. It was kind of inspiring. We first kind of started our literature, one code, one life. It was something to that effect. They had 4 or 5 different iterations, but...
Well, I just remember the one that, if coral don't grow there, we don't go there.
That's very marine. Yeah, that's very
I like
marine.
That.
The pretty stuff. Everyone thinks we just work on trained dolphins all day when you talk about being a marine biologist and do coral research. But yeah, like I said, the story is cool. We had a lot of people, including Oceanoptics executives, because they kind of told us what to do for the most part. Tell your story, because you got a cool story. I mean, I grew up and born and raised in Tarpon Springs, a few clicks north of here. So I've been here my entire life on the ocean, on the Gulf. You got a cool story. You employ all St. Pedians. You're a group of renowned scientists, but it's hard to lose the stigma of Florida a lot of times, especially being a scientist.
What's the stigma?
That we're Florida. You go to retire. Oh, you don't go to do world-class
gotcha.
Science. Okay, we're kind of Disney World down here. And if you watch Saturday Night Live, they always spoof on Florida. Florida
well,
person.
Is... Yeah, sometimes we deserve it, but yeah.
So yeah, I'm not saying a lot of it isn't deserved, but as a scientist, it can be tough sometimes. Yeah. People don't know USF outside in California is a world-renowned research institution just because we're not as advertised, I guess. So, but I like being the underdog too.
It's a lot of cool stuff coming up.
It is cool stuff. We got a cool story.
Well, my grandfather, who was a snowbird, said that in Philadelphia, they bury the dead below the ground. In New Orleans, they bury the dead above the ground. And in Florida, they let them walk around.
We can edit that, right?
No, we're leaving leaving that one in. We're leaving that in. I mean, I have to throw in the average age in St. Pete is 42. So we'll go with that.
That's gone down 10 years since the 30 years I've been here because it was 54.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And I think, too, this was appealing to our family as we considered moving here. That St. Pete isn't like the rest of Florida in a lot of ways. Yeah. It's a very progressive city. It's a very dynamic city. It's a beautiful city, and it's an easy place to live. And I think from an outsider's perspective, often when you think about Florida, you think about retirees, you think about Disney, or you think Miami or the Panhandle. St. Pete is not any of those things. It's its own unique universe, and it is truly a magical place. Everyone is back home where it's snowing right now is so jealous about my Facebook post.
I saw a Facebook post you put up of like a palm tree.
It's just going to get worse. I just wait all winter. Yeah, but it is really a magical place, and it's exciting to get to tell that story because there's something very special about St. Petersburg.
No, Jason, I want to ask you, what's next for the partnership? What can people be on the lookout for?
We have some internal goals and some external goals. Internally, we want to do a better job of communicating who we are and what we do. We're an old organization. We were started in the 60s, actually acquiring land to go out and recruit USF to build USFSP. That was actually the foundation of our organization. We've done a lot of things in the meantime, including helping to support Innovation District, but we're going to be a little bit more aggressive about telling people our story and what we do. And then also there's some big projects coming up that we really want to take a look at playing a constructive role in. One is helping to continue to build and support marine science and telling the marine science story about this community. I hope you hear the passion in my voice when I talk about it, because I'm really excited to share this story nationally and make sure people know about what's going on here as an outside perspective, not from a scientific perspective, but just as a city booster perspective. The Tropicana Field gas plant redevelopment is something that we really are interested in playing a constructive role with the city in, making sure that whatever gets developed there is something that's exciting and dynamic and not sort of lowest common denominator, but something that everyone will be excited about and look back on and say, wow, it's so great that we thought about making this development something really, truly world-class and really incredible. And I think it's going to be really exciting. We caught a lot of other irons in the fire right now and more to come on that. But those are some of the big projects that we're really going to spend a lot of time working on.
Excellent. Is there anything I didn't ask you guys that you want to make sure that the listeners hear about or know about? And I can say for sure, definitely check out the websites of both organizations to see more about them. Check out a future Innovation District tour because I'll circle back and come see. The last time we did a tour with Pure Molecular, we were in the other space. Now they're in a really cool space and we'll have to come back through, bring my group. So we do tours quarterly of the Innovation District and the Downtown Partnership has been kind enough to sponsor those, which has been awesome.
Very cool.
And we're going to continue to do those through next year. And then we'll see, you know, if there's interest, we'll keep going. We go to 4 locations each time. So we highlight a marine science organization, a life science, an education. And then the last one is usually arts or entrepreneurship. And so we try to get to each one of those, give everybody a chance to see and touch and feel and kind of get excited about what's going on. So our time is up. Can you believe that? I know. I told you guys it would be fast. So let me close this out. First of all, I want to thank you guys for joining me today. I really appreciate it. Check out stpeteinnovationdistrict.com for information about upcoming events and to subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter where you often get some updates about these organizations and others. So thanks, everybody, and have a great day.